Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the most bloated government program contributing to the deficit that appears immune to Washington's hand-wringing over the fiscal cliff, and that is the military budget. The author of Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy, investigative journalist Andrew Coburn, joins us. He has an article in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times defending defense cuts. When it comes to the U.S. military budget, the fiscal cliff isn't all that scary. Then we'll look into the role of Senator Feinstein's husband, Richard Blum, the head of the world's largest commercial real estate company, who has an exclusive contract with the U.S. Postal Service to list and sell its valuable and historic public property as the Congress deliberately bankrupts the post office in the name of free enterprise. UC Berkeley professor of geography Gray Breschen joins us to discuss the theft of our national heritage, which the press is ignoring while only reporting that the Postal Service is in default, but not why, and who is profiting from its deliberate destruction. Then finally, we'll examine the newly sworn-in Mexican president Peña Nieto and the makeup of his cabinet with George Grayson, the author of Mexican Messiah, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, and Criminal Entrepreneurs. We will discuss the possibility of immigration reform and a new approach to the failed war on drugs that has claimed over 50,000 Mexican lives in the last 6 years. Joining us now is Andrew Coburn, an investigative journalist and author of several books on defense and international affairs. He's also written about the Middle East for The New Yorker and co-produced the 1991 PBS documentary on Iraq, The War We Left Behind. His latest book is Rumsfeld, The Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. And he has an article in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times defending defense cuts. When it comes to the U.S. military budget, the fiscal cliff isn't all that scary. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Coburn.
Good to be with you.
And it is a pretty extraordinary to learn, and as I think most people did via the Petraeus scandal, the extent to which not only are there military groupies chasing these beribboned generals around like groupies chasing rock stars, but they have a fairly lavish lifestyle with private jets, police motorcade, motorcycle escorts, cooks, and valets. Do you think that the constant refrain in the press and amongst our politicians about paying homage to our fighting men is being somewhat revised here, or are they still immune from the kind of criticism that they clearly deserve?
I think they've taken a bit of a dent. I mean, it's kind of absurd to call them fighting men because they don't actually do much fighting. But they live like gods. They have, you know, very commodious houses. They have very extensive and attentive staffs. And I think most important of all, no one ever contradicts them. So, which might account for some of the problems we've been having.
Well, apparently that was the problem that Petraeus was having at the CIA. Their culture is such where junior officers are encouraged to weigh in with their criticisms. And apparently Petraeus simply couldn't handle the idea that these young insubordinate upstarts were talking back to him.
Right. If you've been a, you know, if he's... I don't think anyone's probably done that since he got his first star as a general. I mean, generals, and particularly when you get to the 3- and 4-star level, generals are treated like, as I said, like gods. But of course, you know, the cooks and valets are are the least of our problems. But I think it, you know, indicates the mindset. It's a militaristic mindset. It also reminds me of the parody of a Latin American general. I mean, I don't want to single them out, or weighed down with gold epaulettes, gold stars and all that. That's what we're getting to, and I think it's very dangerous and decadent, really.
Well, apparently there are more shoes to drop in the Petraeus affair. That's my understanding. I don't know quite what to make of that, but already. Do you have any?
Well, I don't know. I think first of all, you have to start with the presumption that is it really so likely that merely because a low-level FBI agent has discovered that the director of Central Intelligence is having has had an extramarital affair that they're going to turf out the head of the CIA for that? You know, it's inherently unlikely. So if even if that was the excuse, there had to be, and I don't you know, since I can't say I've sort of checked it, I don't want to sort of just spout off rumors on the air, but they, you know, one in Washington, you do hear a lot of suggestions that they had much more serious issues with Petraeus and gave him the option of just resigning over this, which, you know, people could, you know, all his supporters came out in Washington and said, oh, it's so terrible, we're losing the great hero Petraeus. And, you know, practically some of the sort of news correspondents who've been getting his leaks for years were practically in tears when they announced the news. But that, you know, so that was fairly benign, but I'm convinced that there was, you know, a much more serious reason for letting him go, like that.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Coburn, who's an investigative journalist and author of several books on defense and international affairs. His latest book is Rumsfeld, The Rise and Fall, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. And he has an article in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times, Defending Defense Cuts. When it comes to the U.S. military budget, the fiscal cliff isn't all that scary. Now, do you think, Andrew Coburn, that the only way the defense budget will be cut is via the sequester? In other words, it's never been cut in spite of, going back to 1960, the warning by outgoing President Eisenhower about the military-industrial complex. It's inexorably grown and has become a kind of form of right-wing welfare in this country that's untouchable.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, not many people realize that we're way above the Cold War average. You know, if you measure it, you know, accounting for inflation. You know, for all those years, we've had this enormous budget, which I always thought was, you know, ridiculously inflated anyway. But they were, at least, the excuse was they were confronting a superpower, you know, the Soviet Union, which had a very extensive, albeit overrated, military of its own. Now, you know, there's nothing like that. I mean, we outspend, you know, we spend as much as the rest of the world put together, and yet the budget is higher, really, in real terms, than it was during the Cold War, which is completely absurd, obviously. And, you know, amazingly, if this sequester thing goes through, it will, for the first time, suffer a serious cut. I mean, not that serious. If sequester is kind of a big mouthful of a word, but, you know, if these mandatory cuts are fully implemented, we'll go back to the level we were in 2007.
Right.
It seemed pretty vast then, but it shows how much bigger it is now. But, you know, as I said in the article, you know, to listen to the defense chiefs and the Secretary of Defense and all the think tanks and the whole enormous tribe that lives off this, I mean, you know, we'll be doomed. And, you know, I don't know, the North Koreans and Al-Qaeda will be stomping all over us if this thing goes through.
Well, one of the things you point out in the article is, which is shocking, is that the Lightning II, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, currently consumes no less than 38% of the entire defense procurement budget. Now, the sequester is a blunt instrument, so presumably they're going to cut across the board. But surely that one, I mean, I've spoken to Pierre Spray, the designer of the the A-10 attack fighter and the F-16, the very successful U.S. aircraft. And He's been railing against the F-22 Raptor for some time, and this turkey, this F-35. And basically, his argument is that this stealth technology is a complete myth. It's a hoax that the defense industries came up with this new branding that they're able to soak the taxpayer for. And it turns out to, because it's so cumbersome, it turns these planes into flying turkeys.
Well, that's right. And it doesn't, I mean, you know, we should make it very clear that it doesn't make the planes invisible to radar. It makes them, it diminishes their radar signature at certain profiles. I mean, it depends which way the plane is facing. And, you know, as I point out, certain wavelengths of, you know, the stealth features embodied in the aircraft are designed against particular wavelength radars, long wavelength radars, which the Russians have been making for a very long time. Aren't bothered by this. So, as I point out, the Russians make an extremely efficient and very affordable long wavelength radar at the moment, which they're marketing around. I mean, it's portable. You can drive it around the roads. And it's a very affordable at $10 million. So against the, I don't know what we want to price the F-35 per copy at now, I think $400 million is quite a is a reasonable estimate, probably an underestimate. Against that, and a lot of that $400 million is this stealth, you know, supposedly magic stealth technology. If you nip around the corner to the Russian Arms Export Agency and slap down $10 million, you can have a radar that detects it.
And the overall, as you point out in your article in the Los Angeles Times, Andrew Coben, in defense of defense cuts, when it comes to the U.S. military, the fiscal cliff isn't all that scary. The oversight put the overall lifetime, the government oversight project puts the overall lifetime cost of the F-35 at $1.5 trillion, more than the annual gross domestic product of Spain.
isn't that amazing? This is one pretty, you know, not very bad performing fighter plane. I mean, $1.5 trillion, that's amazing.
Right, and its predecessor, the F-22, the pilots are blacking out because of the oxygen. I mean, they've had oxygen in airplanes since the 1930s, and somehow the state-of-the-art aircraft can't feed oxygen without making their pilots unconscious. And
right, because the oxygen into the intake for the pilot's oxygen supply, actually, it looks like it's getting polluted with some of the toxins from the stealth coatings on the engine intake. So it's stealth strikes again, really.
And the Navy is also, this is, we're talking about the Air Force's snout in the government trough here, but the Navy's got this 3,000-ton littoral combat ship at $500 million a copy. It apparently has a tendency to veer off course at high speeds and develop cracks and rust. That's in your article.
Almost immediately, yeah. It's because they tried to be clever and reduce the weight by mixing, you know, building the hull is on one part on the top it's aluminum and then it's steel. But it turns out it's very, very hard to bond aluminum and steel. And certainly as far as the littoral combat ship is concerned. So they've had a huge problem with cracks and also, consequent to the cracks, rust. And then they... As you said, at high speeds, the official euphemism is directional instability. It means that if it gets in a well-designed ship, if you're proceeding along and a wave knocks it, you know, half a degree to one side or the other, it'll has a tendency to go back, you know, keep going straight. With this ship, it keeps swinging, so the helmsman has to sort of keep jerking the tiller to keep it going in a roughly straight line.
And further in terms of the fiscal follies here, you've got the Army wanting to spend $34 billion on the ground fighting vehicle, which is a troop carrier projected to weigh up to 84 tons, which is more than the M1 Abrams tank. And then you've also got another project which is actually being deployed, Gorgon Stare, which is a drone-mounted video system supposedly able to surveil a whole town day and night, and it's failed its tests so dramatically that testers urge it not to be fielded, but the Air Force shipped it to Afghanistan anyway. What's the latest on how it's doing in Afghanistan?
Well, every time I ask, you know, when you ask the Air Force, as I've done repeatedly, say, well, give me some details on how it's performing, and the people in the Air Force team that did the tests, I mean, they isolated a whole number of problems or identified a whole number of problems. So I periodically write to the Air Force saying, you know, how have you overcome the following problems? And if so, how? Well, maybe they can't tell me how, but it'd be nice to know that they have overcome the problems. The Air Force refuses to reply, simply saying, oh, it's doing wonderfully. And, you know, the reports from the troops in the field are ecstatic about this tremendous aid in fighting the Afghan war. Well, I know a lot of people who are or have been on the ground in Afghanistan, U.S. soldiers and Marines, and I keep asking them. I said, have you found Gorgon Stare useful? And they say, what's that? We never heard of it. So it's been deployed, but it's been kept, it's not being much used to anyone as far as I can tell, because they haven't told the troops about it. Maybe because, it's, as I suspect, it's not really working very well.
So, Andrew Coburn, what's your understanding of whether this president, now that he's got something of a mandate, even though the Republicans are denying him any kind of credit for winning a second term and for picking up, and the Democrats are picking up extra seats in the Senate, he's did in his debate with Romney more or less humiliate Romney when he talked about how Romney complained about how our defenses were being eviscerated by Obama. And of course, Obama pointed out, made the joke about, you know, in response to the notion that we have the smallest Navy since 1916, he rather patronizingly explained about submarines and aircraft carriers to Romney. But beyond that, is there any indication that Obama gets it, that since the Republicans essentially being hoisted on their own petard, and it looks like the Democrats may just let this fiscal cliff hyperbole happen, and Obama can basically blame it on them, can't he?
Well, he can, yes. I mean, it's, you know, who knows, but, I mean, you know, there's always a suspicion that he'll follow his usual, his customary instincts and sort of give away a bit of the store. Like, you know, there's a terrible possibility that he'll say, okay, well, we've got a deal on tax increases for the wealthy, and in return, yes, we're going to chop Medicare, raise the Medicare age when you can get Medicare, which will be, in effect, a, you know, privatization of part of Medicare. Or, you know, do something to Social Security. But let's hope he doesn't. Maybe he won't. He doesn't have to, of course. And, you know, he may get it about defense. I mean, the problem is that if they just chop, if the sequester, the way it's officially, you know, it's framed, just chopping, you know, X percent off across the board, I mean, that will cause a lot of problems. I mean, better than not cutting it at all, but I mean, you really need to sort of cut out sort of turkeys like the F-35 or the littoral combat ship and, you know, in fact, cut them out anyway, whether you're cutting the budget or not. Will Obama stand up to the defense lobby like no president has done since Eisenhower, which he did like a week before he was leaving office? It doesn't really count.
Right. Well, of course,
I don't know. Would it be in character? I mean, Obama loves... He, as we all know, he loves drones. He loves, you know, super elite commando, special force, SEAL Team 6 type things. And he loves all that sort of covert world. Perhaps in the mistaken belief that it's cheap, which it certainly isn't. And he may use the authority he's got, both from his, you know, the election, from the mandate, you know, that mandate, and from, you know, this hysteria over the impending, you know, fiscal crisis, which, you know, is entirely artificial, because we don't need to have all these cuts, really.
Well, but also, it's also not just artificial. It's distracting us from the debate we should be having, which is about austerity, which is a disaster.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really an excuse. I mean, it's, you know, as I'm sure you know, I mean, it's really a well, clever marketing campaign to get, you know, to ram, you know, Greek or at least Spanish style austerity down our throats, which, you know, one can hope that Obama will fight that, but I'm not that hopeful.
Well, Andrew Coburn, I thank you for your piece in the LA Times and for joining us here today.
Well, thank you. Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Coburn, who's an investigative journalist and author of several books on defense and international affairs. He's also written about the Middle East for The New Yorker and co-produced the 1991 PBS documentary on Iraq, The War We Left Behind. His latest book is Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. And he has an article in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times, Defending Defense Cuts. When it comes to the U.S. military budget, the fiscal cliff isn't that scary. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how Senator Feinstein's husband is profiting from the deliberate destruction of the United States Postal Service.
How low were you willing to go? all you need, child, is a